Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On our program today, there are calls in Lansing to overhaul Michigan's parole system. Advocates say the state's keeping people in prison far longer than necessary. Then later in the program, we switch gears. We'll go back in time and explore how a Michigan company fed the nation's craze for picture postcards. But first, Detroit voters have spoken, well, at least the 15% or so who voted in Tuesday's primary. And it will be Mike Duggan versus Benny Napoleon in the race for Detroit's next mayor. We'll talk with our political analyst Jack Lessenberry to get his take on the primary results. But first, we want to talk with the candidates. We're joined now by the top vote-getter in yesterday's mayoral primary, a candidate whose name wasn't even on the ballot. Mike Duggan, welcome back to Stateside.
Well, thanks for having me.
So were you surprised? I know you called this a mission impossible when you launched the write-in part of your campaign. What do you think happened?
Well, you know, the last couple of weeks, there's no doubt that we had huge momentum. Every place I went in the city, I had people coming up and spelling my name and telling me they were going to be with me. And the city's ready for change. And it looks like we won something like 600 out of 614 precincts. It was from one end of the city to another. I think there's a lot of feeling of hope here.
What do you think that you did right during this campaign? I know you launched everything with the series of meetings in homes around Detroit. You were at, 185 homes?
Well, there's no doubt that the house parties were what did this. And I was at 185 homes and living rooms and backyards and church halls and apartment complexes and talked to more than 10,000 people face-to-face in those settings. And that generated 5,000 campaign volunteers from people when you sit with them and you say, okay, here's what we can do about the abandoned house. Here's what we can do to get the police to show up. Here's what we can do to get the streetlights on. They start to get excited and they get motivated, and that was the group that carried me in.
Now, your hope was you'd be in the top two. Did you ever expect such to come in on first and by such a large margin?
I'd say in the last 10 days, we were confident we were going to come in first. The margin was amazing, to be up 20 points when everybody who votes for you has to figure out how to navigate the write-in process, which has not happened before in Detroit, is pretty remarkable. But it gives you an idea of the depth of commitment people have in the city to fighting back.
Now, you and Benny Napoleon stayed clear of talking about race during the primary campaign. Others, including some of the other candidates, did not. What would you say to those who persist in making race a key issue in this campaign?
Well, everybody who's done it has helped my candidacy because the vast majority of Detroiters are ready to get past whatever the historic differences are because we have so much more in common than we have differences. And when there's an abandoned house next to you that you are going to sleep at night worrying is going to catch fire and spread and get you and your family, the race of the person who's running is a secondary issue to you. You want to know who's got the ability to solve this problem, make me safe in this neighborhood, who's got the ability to bring in businesses and jobs so that folks in this town can be working. And you can see from the results yesterday that I think I won among the black community by more than 10 points. And Sheriff Napoleon is a pretty popular candidate, so that wasn't an easy accomplishment.
Now, we know that primary elections draw a small fraction of voters, and that's true across the state. So there's a lot of work to be done before November. And there are those who say you've been light on specifics in this primary campaign. They really want to hear exactly how you're going to attract the kinds of employees that the city needs and what you can do to regain its economic power. Do you think that criticism was valid?
Anybody who's been to any of my house parties knows it's not valid. You don't spend 2 hours in people's living rooms without having specifics. And I've gone through in detail specific plans for the businesses, specific plans for the neighborhoods, specific plans for the police. But, of course, what was covered in the media is, some barber, files a write-in campaign or, a lot of the divisive stuff. But by not being specific, and we'll formally release a plan in the next couple of weeks.
You have been clear during the campaign that you don't believe the city needed an emergency manager, and it's just as clear that Governor Snyder feels differently. How would you work with Kevin Orr if you're elected?
Well, you know, my objective is going to be to transition the emergency manager out at the earliest possible date. And, you know, the governor's stated reason for bringing this story in was that the last administration was not making progress on the things that they had promised to do under the consent agreement to straighten out the finance. And my point is, on November 5th, we will have elected a mayor who's got a great deal of turnaround and financial management experience. And he's got the ability to deliver on those things. There's no longer any justification to deny people the right to select their own leaders. And so I'm hoping that the business leaders and the community leaders who are supporting me join me in going to see the governor right after November 5th and asking him to dissolve the emergency manager and return Detroit back to the elected officials selected by the voters.
Mike Duggan, thank you for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you very much for the time.
And we're joined now by Sheriff Benny Napoleon, who is running to be the next mayor of Detroit. Welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thank you so much, Cindy.
Benny, what do you think voters said by choosing you as mayoral candidate?
Well, I mean, I think it's a reflection of the long history I had in the city. People in the city know me well, and they trust me. They trust my message. And I think that they recognize that we need new leadership in this community.
Now, you had been pegged by many observers as the front runner in the primary. And I'm wondering, now that the election day is over and it's time to look at results and move ahead to November, what do you and your team take away from Mike Duggan's strong showing yesterday?
Well, he ran a very strategic and surgical campaign, obviously. And, you know, there are lessons to be learned from that. So. And it was extremely well financed. You're talking $3 million as opposed to about $600 that I raised. So, you know, he kind of outspent me about 5-1. So, you know, certainly money is significant when it comes to a race of this size. But we're undeterred by that. The fact is, that's just the primary race and the general race in Detroit are two different types of races. So, and you had an extremely low turnout for the primary. So obviously we need to get a larger turnout in November, get our message back out, and make some adjustments. But we're moving forward.
And now that you are, it's time now to focus on the general election. You've cleared the primary hurdle. And there are calls for you and for Mr. Duggan to really put out the specifics, how you'll lead the city and how you'll attract that strong team needed to shepherd the city post-bankruptcy and how you'll improve the business climate. So can you give us a sense how you're going to be shaping your campaign message going forward?
Well, the message will remain very much the same because we know what the issues are. The issues are not unknown to folks. We know we've got issues with our finances. We have issues with crime. We have issues with blight. We have some problems with education. There's insurance and taxes. You know, we've got some strain on city services. Those issues are very well known. The question is, how are you going to address them and what are you going to prioritize? For me, as a lifelong resident of the city of Detroit, I know that public safety is paramount to changing the landscape of this community. People need to feel that they are living in a safe city. And we've gone from a city of 1.7 million people down to 700,000, predominantly because our streets have not been safe and our schools have not been good. So you have to focus on those two things. And obviously, jobs have moved away, so we have to bring in new employment. So those are the things that will shape our message. Now, as it relates to the specificity of it, you know, we will both present a written plan, I am sure. I am in the process of finalizing mine and putting it out for the world to scrutinize. So, you know, we just have to work on getting our message out and convincing folks today that my message is solid, B, that my plan is the best, and three, that I'm the best person to lead this community forward. So we have a similar task, probably going down different routes.
You and Mike Duggan both refrained from racial overtones during your campaigns. Others did not. Did voters repudiate race baiting and race talk by choosing both of you yesterday? And what do you say to those who persist in making race an issue in this?
I said from the beginning that the only people that I've heard really talk about race have been folks in the media. I think the citizens of the city of Detroit have demonstrated over time that they will elect a candidate based upon what that candidate represents, irrespective of race. That has been shown time and time again in the city of Detroit. The most obvious difference between Mike and I when we walk into the room is that he and I are both men, and one is African American and one is white. We don't have to talk about that. That's there. It's visual. Everyone knows it. So that's really not even part of the discussion. We need to focus on the issues. We need to focus on the solutions. We need to focus on making this city a better city. So I haven't engaged in it. Mike hasn't engaged in it, and I don't plan on engaging in it, and I'm certain he won't.
And looking ahead, November comes, November goes, and you are the mayor of Detroit. How will you work with emergency manager Kevin Orr after that?
Well, I just think that the bankruptcy process places the onus for moving the city forward from a financial standpoint on the bankruptcy judge, and anyone can do that. So I think I'm more than capable of following the directions given by the bankruptcy court, who will be in charge. I don't see why we need Kevin Orr at that point. I don't see why we need him at this point. I've been opposed to the emergency manager on very fundamental grounds and fundamental principles, and I remain there. If, in fact, it is determined that he is there and he is there lawfully, then we'll have to address it at that time. I'm an officer of the court as a lawyer, and I will always comply with the law. So, I mean, at this point, he's there, and he's there according to the Michigan courts legitimately. But when the federal court makes a decision, then we have to move forward from there.
Sheriff Benny Napoleon, thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
Okay, you're welcome. Bye-bye.
Coming up, should Michigan overhaul its parole system? That story in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We just heard from Detroit's two mayoral candidates, Mike Duggan and Benny Napoleon. And if you miss those conversations, you can find them on our website at michiganradio.org. Well, despite being booted off the ballot and being forced to launch that write-in candidacy, Mike Duggan was by far the most popular choice. We should note Tuesday's election numbers will not be official until certified by county canvassers. Now, to help us kind of figure out what yesterday's primary vote means, we're joined now by Michigan Radio's political analyst, Jack Lessenberry. Hi, Jack.
Hello there.
Did anything in the results of the primary surprise you?
Well, I think the how many votes were cast for Duggan. First of all, the turnout is bigger than people think it is because the number of registered voters that they're using is utterly fictitious. They haven't purged the rolls in a long time.
Right.
There's no way there's 550,000 registered voters out of a population of maybe 680,000. But more than half of the people who voted yesterday wrote in Mike Duggan's name or meant to write in Mike Duggan's name. And the thing that shocks me the most is that nearly 90% of them spelled his name right, both first and last name. And so while there's going to be, of course, hopefully a higher turnout in November and a different electorate, he now really is the man to beat.
And what did all of that, what is the message Detroit voters sent by doing this?
The message voters sent is that they just want the city fixed, and they see him as the most likely candidate to fix it, by which I mean have police that will come in some kind of, it won't take an hour before they get there, have streetlights come on, have garbage picked up. They see him as sort of a Mr. Fix-It, somebody who fixed up the Detroit Medical Center and has a history of getting things done from his years in Wayne County. And they move beyond, most of them, certainly beyond racial politics and posturing politics, which I think is an encouraging sign.
Although we certainly saw a lot of the racial politics and posturing politics during the campaign with pointed references to, you know, Mike Duggan having moved from Livonia to Detroit. So our voters,
You saw that, but it didn't translate in the votes. The main person who was running that was Tom Barrow. And if there's anything we know is that the people of Detroit do not want Tom Barrow to be mayor. This is the fourth time they've rejected him. He ran twice in the 80s, went to federal prison, mm-hmm. has run twice since. And Tom Barrow, for all of his name recognition and all of his tub-thumping, got slightly less than 4% of the vote.
So I guess the question was, is it going to be wise for anyone who supports either candidate to back away from touching on race?
I think so. I think there's going to be sort of an unstated. There are going to be people who say, do we want to turn the city over to them? And there's going to be some people who, now Benny Napoleon has not been running that kind of campaign, but Benny Napoleon is African-American, has lived in Detroit his entire life, whereas Mike Duggan has lived in Detroit for about 14 months, a little more than that. He moved in early 2012. But, you know, if that's an issue, if that's an issue for people, they may well vote for Napoleon. But of the people who voted last night, they chose Duggan by a decisive margin.
And Duggan has said right from the beginning when he was holding those home meetings that he heard over and over again, we don't care what color our mayor is, just get the job done.
Well, that's right. And he was turned. And I think, ironically, the fact that he was ruled off the ballot, which seemed unfair to people, is a very technical decision. He probably, in my view, did better than if he'd been on the ballot.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. And then having Mike the Barber added a day before the deadline probably also added to all of that for him.
It's very clear to me that we, the media, pay too much attention to sideshows like Mike the Barber and this person who we call a union activist, Robert Davis, who actually is under federal indictment for stealing money from the Highland Park schools, who filed lawsuits about every day. Mike the Barber, I'm looking at a whole list of all the absentees. Mike the Barber got either 17 or 26 votes, depending on how you count how people spelled his name. So we gave him an awful lot of airtime and an awful lot of ink, and virtually nobody voted for him.
Now, Benny Napoleon had been kind of pegged as the front runner, Jack. What happened, do you think?
I think what happened was Benny Napoleon has been around for a long time, is a very charismatic and likable man, no taint of personal scandal. Benny Napoleon seemed unable to articulate anything other than the crime issue. Now, when I've talked to him during the campaign, he gives a very good, you know, definition of what needs to be done as far as crime in Detroit. He's very eloquent about that, about mistakes the Bing administration did, abolishing the gang squad, say. But he hasn't really been able to convince people that he could tackle the other problems of the city. And to some extent, people see him as part, I think, of the same old, same old. And indeed, when he was the police chief in Detroit some years ago, crime went down a little bit, but there were problems balancing the budget. The city was put under a consent agreement. So while I think people really like Benny, and he encourages people to call him Benny, they're not as confident that he could get the job done.
Did you want to hear more from Mike Duggan during the primary as far as specifics? Because he did take some criticism for really not getting into how he was going to affect things and also kind of acting like things were the way they were under Ed McNamara.
I think it's a very good criticism. I think that to some extent Mike Duggan, all the candidates, Mike Duggan sort of demagogued it too. Mike Duggan said we don't need an emergency manager, bankruptcy, we didn't need bankruptcy. And I know that in his heart of hearts, Mike Duggan knows that both things were inevitable. But I think now, yes, I think what we need and what the media should demand and the voters should demand is that both Benny Napoleon and Mike Duggan say, here is how we are going to, what we're going to do once the emergency manager is gone, to make sure this never happens again, and to lead Detroit on the path to solvency. And in the meantime, we're going to have Kevin Orr here till October 2014. How is that mayor going to work with him? I think people really want to hear that. And indeed, Mike, if Napoleon hasn't really talked about anything other than crime, Mike Duggan has at times appeared to act like, you know, you could have the good old era of the big city mayor boss, like Mayor Daley in Chicago, to some extent, like Ed McNamara in Wayne County in the 1980s and 90s. But that era is gone, too, and he needs to show he can move beyond that.
And what will you be looking for from these candidates, mayor and council, between now and November?
I'm looking for some signal of how they think once the bankruptcy is done, we have to start thinking about that, about in Germany they called the period right after World War II ended, Stunde Null, which meant 0 hour. And so we have to talk about 0 hour. How do you rebuild Detroit? How do you make this place prosperous again? How do you keep it solvent? And how do you prevent Detroit from going through what it's gone through over these last few years? And I want to hear rational ideas from all these candidates about what they would do to do that.
As always, enjoy talking with you, Michigan Radio political analyst Jack Lessenberry. Thank you so much, Jack.
Thank you, Cindy.
Let's turn our attentions now to Lansing. There are calls to overhaul Michigan's parole system. Advocates say the state keeps people in prison far longer than necessary. And as Michigan Public Radio's Jake Neer reports, they say that costs Michigan taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars every year.
Michigan's inmates stay in prison longer than those in any of the 35 states Pew Research Center studied in 2012. For Monica Janer, that meant spending 28 years of her life behind bars. She was sentenced to life in prison for conspiracy to commit murder in 1978. No one died in her case. But Janer doesn't see herself as a victim. She says she spent those 28 years in prison trying to improve her life and the lives of fellow inmates.
I got my degree and, you know, I did a lot while I was there. I didn't just sit around and, you know, I fought and got and helped to get the education for the women. And my journey was a good one because I made a lot of impact on the system, I think.
Janer got her first chance at parole 10 years into her sentence. But right around the same time, a Michigan convict on parole confessed to killing four teenage girls. Janer says that made it nearly impossible for people like her to get in front of the parole board. It was another 18 years before she walked out the front door of Scott Correctional Facility in Plymouth after a string of parole battles. She now works with former inmates and parolees to get their lives on track and advocates for prisoners who are still inside.
I go door to door to go out there and let people see, you know, you can give people a second chance. When they find out I've been to prison, I mean, literally heads, you know, spin around.
Janer believes the only reason she won parole was because third-party prisoner advocates took interest in her case. One of those groups was the Michigan-based Citizens Alliance on Prisons and Public Spending, or CAPS. Executive Director Laura Sager says prisoners are too often denied parole based on so-called tough-on-crime politics and preconceived notions of who prisoners are.
We really need to stay close to the evidence. We need to understand what works and what works both to prevent crime and who's at real risk for recommitting crimes.
Sager says almost 30% of prisoners who have been denied parole fall in the lowest risk category for release. That's based on the Michigan Department of Corrections' own assessment.
We're spending $100 million to keep that group in prison alone.
Among other things, CAP says the state's parole board should be required to release prisoners when they first become eligible. That's unless objective evidence suggests they're a risk to public safety. Sager says that would free up hundreds of millions of dollars the state could spend on programs that are proven to improve public safety. Things like early childhood education, mental health treatment programs, and substance abuse programs. But Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette isn't buying it.
I suppose if you had no prisons, you'd reduce your corrections costs, but that wouldn't make us safer in Michigan.
Schuette says it would not be fair to victims and their families to see these offenders go free. He says the best way to cut prison costs is more privatization.
Let's run our prisons more efficiently instead of saying, oh, gee, the only way we can cut costs is letting out dangerous prisoners. I'm not going to stand for that.
State House Appropriations Chair Joe Hovman says he agrees there's room for more privatization of prison functions, but he says the only way to really make a dent in the state's $2 billion a year corrections budget is to do something about the prison population and length of stay. But he says it's going to take time to sell the idea of a parole system overhaul to his colleagues in Lansing. In the meantime, advocates say thousands of Michigan prisoners will be fighting an uphill battle for release. For the Michigan Public Radio Network, I'm Jake Neer in Lansing.
So have you heard the rueful little wisecrack about Michigan's weather forecasters? Something like, they're wrong just enough that you don't take them seriously, and they're right just enough that you need to take them seriously. Well, the weather forecasters in Michigan will soon be able to give us forecasts that are, dare we say it, twice as accurate. Mark Torregrossa got his degree in meteorology from Northern Illinois University, and he's been forecasting Michigan's weather for more than two decades. His website, farmerweather.com, specializes in weather information for farmers and agriculture. Mark, why will your forecast soon be twice as accurate?
Well, the National Weather Service, the government, has upgraded the computers, and they're basically about 2.5 times as fast as they used to be. You can look at it as, you know, you have your own laptop there, and you're it's a couple of years old and it starts to get really slow and doggy and you got to reset it all the time. And then you go out and buy a new computer and you can do things a lot faster. And that's what will be happening with the computer models that we get to look at to make forecasts. The government computer models will run faster and they'll have higher resolution, so that should increase the accuracy. Now, I use the word twice as accurate because the speed is a little more than twice the speed, but certainly the accuracy should increase.
And when we say that, are we talking about deciding how much snow we're going to get or how far out you're going to be able to make your forecasts?
All of the factors, and that's what's going to be nice. Let's break it down for you a little bit. One of the short-term computer models that we use goes out 16 hours. Its resolution will go down from 13 kilometers. In meteorology, we always speak kilometers because the rest of the world does.
Right.
Down to 3 kilometers. So basically, imagine the state of Michigan with blocks that are 13 kilometers big across it.
Okay.
One in a computer model, it might say this one block, 13 kilometers, is going to have heavy snow in it. Now, there will be several blocks in that one 13-kilometer block, and it could say heavy snow in these two blocks and not in these three.
Okay.
So snowfall, temperature, and the extended model that we use that goes out 16 days, the resolution on that will increase also, and so that should increase the accuracy of forecast going out 7, 8, 9, 10 days.
And, of course, this is it goes beyond just the convenience of knowing whether or not your weekend plans up north might get rained out. This really becomes a matter of economics and also safety.
Yes, and that's actually how the government figures out if they're going to do these kind of things. They put an economic value on loss of buildings. They even put an economic value on loss of life. And then they run through this and say, they do studies. You know how the government loves to do studies. And they say, well, if we spend this many million dollars on this upgrade in weather computers, it will save this many lives and this much money, and therefore will pay for itself. And pretty much a lot of times they always come up with the fact that increased accuracy is going to save a lot of lives and a lot of property damage.
When will we start noticing these snazzier, more accurate weather forecasts?
They've implemented it in the hurricane model already. That was the first thing, and that's because hurricane season is now. So we may see, you know, for the rest of the country that is affected by hurricanes, we may see better forecast tracks. I think a number they gave me was something like a 15% better forecast track and intensity when a storm makes landfall. That's a big deal when you're not going to evacuate a large city on the East Coast. Because of the accuracy, you save a lot of money and time there and a lot of frustration. Now, for us here in Michigan, we'll start to see the accuracy sometime in the spring of next year when the computer models that we use to make forecasts here in Michigan start to get the upgrades and the increased speed and increased efficiency.
So maybe fingers crossed by meteorologists all over Michigan, maybe more accurate forecasts and a little less grief from the public.
Let's hope so. It's getting better all the time, and it'll just keep getting better. Mother Nature will always throw us a curve once in a while, but one of these days we'll nail it completely, and then probably for me, the fun will be gone.
Meteorologist Mark Torregrossa of FarmerWeather.com, also the MLive meteorologist. Thanks for talking with us today, Mark.
Thank you.
A reminder for everyone, Michigan Radio's political junkie Zoe Clark and her It's Just Politics co-host Rick Pluta are in Holland for a special Issues in Ale event. It will be this evening at 6:30 in downtown Holland, right there at the New Holland Brewing Company. They'll talk Michigan politics, the Detroit bankruptcy, election 2013, election 2014, and they want you to join in on the conversation. The evening will be hosted by Michigan Radio's investigative journalist, Lester Graham of Michigan Watch. You can get more details at michiganradio.org. Coming up next, how a Detroit publishing company fed the nation's demand for picture postcards more than a century ago. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, think for a moment. When's the last time you mailed a postcard? Sadly, posting a photo or video from your smartphone onto Facebook or Twitter seems to have supplanted the good old postcard. But there is a very, very rich history to the American picture postcard, and guess what? It centers on Detroit. The city that put the world on wheels is also the city that turned out millions and millions of American postcards, and what a story they tell. John Collier spent 3 decades as a photojournalist for the Detroit Free Press. He's also a filmmaker, and he has turned his love of postcards into a documentary that he calls My Postcard Collection, The Detroit Publishing Story, A History of the American Picture Postcard. And John Collier joins us in the studio. So good to have you with us, John.
Thanks for having me.
Give us a sense, John, because it's so ubiquitous. You walk into any store, if you're up north or you're in Europe or wherever, and there's the rack of postcards. But when did the postcard become part of Americans' lives?
Well, it actually started in the 1890s when people started mailing postcards like we make phone calls and post on the internet. They sent millions of them. In fact, Detroit Publishing supplied 7 million postcards in 1907. They were huge. It was the kind of thing where 2 or 3 times a day you would send a postcard to your brother, to your sister. They were ubiquitous in that time. Everyone postcarded. Then the radio came in, the telephone came in, and World War I kind of killed that habit of sending those postcards. But, I mean, they sent millions of them, and they're still around today. You can go to postcard shows. You'll be amazed. You look at San Francisco earthquake. There are just millions and millions of them, and they're $1 or $2. And you can't believe you can buy an antique as beautiful as it is for $1. And so they're very attractive items. They reflect American history, and you love looking at them.
Now, how did Detroit wind up becoming such a major player in American picture postcards? Talk to us about the Detroit Publishing Company.
They started about 1897, and they immediately hired William Henry Jackson, who was a famous photographer. He'd spent the last 30 or 40 years in the Southwest photographing all of the attractions there. So he brought his 20 or 30,000 negatives to Detroit. And they set up there. I think they were going to put pictures on walls so that people could look at them. Well, the picture postcard craze came in at that time, and people just went for postcards. They just loved them, and they sent them all over the world. You can find these. In fact, I found them in Paris. I found them in England, right from Detroit and Detroit Publishing. So they kind of saw the market, and they started, and it was just like, boom, you know. The world changed, and people just sent postcards to everybody.
Now, I'm interested in the reason behind it, and I'll say that because here so many of us travel a lot. Here we are in 2013, probably more likely to travel than somebody, say, in 1890. So were they using picture postcards the same way we do, like, hey, I'm in New York City, and here's a photo postcard of the Flatiron Building. Isn't it cool? And without so many people and without so much traveling, how did that amount to such huge sales?
You know, if you look at American history, long about this time was the leisure time came in. People were leaving the farm. They were coming into the city, and they were finding themselves with more time, more leisure time. And so they just picked this up as a very attractive thing to do. And I think there must be something instinctual, could I say?
Yes.
About wanting to send a friend or a relative a picture and a message. Mm-hmm. And the combination of the two give you great information. Now, back then, they didn't have picture magazines or television. So this was something really new. And so you'd go to your uncle's house, and he'd have a postcard book. And you'd sit there and look at this postcard book, and you'd see things that you could never see otherwise. So it was more than just travel. It was they were news vehicles. They provided that sort of visual substance to look at and to inform you about what your world was like. And they were incredibly popular. People just loved them and to this day love them. You know, they collect them. I ran into some collectors, some famous collectors, Leonard Lauder. Mm-hmm. He'll spend $30,000 or $40,000 in a weekend buying postcards. You talk to him, his eyes sparkle because he loves these things. And he gave his to the Whitney Museum and the Metropolitan Museum. They're now worth a lot of money. And it put postcards as not being kitsch items like pink flamingos. They're now considered fine art, and rightfully so, because they are.
So let's say I lived in a small community in the Thumb, and we decided to make a trip to the big city. So we went to Detroit. Would I then have gone in and bought some postcards and sent them to my aunts and uncles and my cousins and my grandma and my grandpa?
Exactly.
All over the country to go, I'm in Detroit.
Exactly. And beyond that are what are called real photo postcards. So let's say I have one from Chelsea, a fire at a hotel. The photographer, local photographer, would go out there and take a picture. He'd print up maybe 100 postcards, real photo postcards, and then put them for sale in the local dime store. People would come in and buy that card. It was news, and send it to their brothers and sisters. Here's the big fire at the hotel last night. Those are very popular, and they do reflect so much an intimate part of American history that you just don't quite get when you read history accountings of that time.
Yes, because you'd have impressions and you'd have their greetings on the other side.
And I must say that at that time, innovation was overwhelming for the people of that era. The automobile came in, and there were trains already. The telephone came in and radio came in. And it was just like the accounts I got was people said, well, we didn't feel like the world was changing. We felt like we were living in a new world.
Mm. I am speaking with John Collier, who has produced a documentary that's called My Postcard Collection, The Detroit Publishing Story, A History of the American Picture Postcard. And Detroit, because of this Detroit publishing company, really became a major player in picture postcards. And I'm wondering, and you're a photographer, so you might be able to tell us this, what made those colored postcards from Detroit Publishing Company look so alive? The color is wonderful. Do we know how they got that coloring?
Oh, yeah. We do. Actually, there is a lot of mystery about the particular details of how they did that. They're basically color lithographs. They start with a black and white photograph, and then they make several screens. So let's say the sky is blue. They'll make a separate printing block for that color. And it's all imagined color. The photographer would write down what colors were in the photograph, because color film didn't come along until the late 30s. So these were kind of artificial color, but they looked very real. And it also means that you could enhance the color in it so that the sunset could be much more vibrant and interesting to look at. And they really, really were pretty. Most Detroit publishing postcards cost from $1 to $5, but some of them cost $200, $300, $400, some of the better ones.
And for collectors, not back in the day.
Exactly. They'd sell two for a nickel back then. And now some of those are Samuel Schmucker was an artist, and he's probably one of the greatest of the postcard artists. And his go for big bucks. He actually had a dwarfed arm, and he had great difficulty in grabbing his paintbrush. Mm-hmm. But he did, however, marry the prettiest girl in art school and painted her for the rest of his life. So his pictures are incredible if you saw them. And Detroit Publishing Printing were specialists in high-quality printing. It just knocked your socks off to look at them. They had so much vibrant color to them and interest, too. After these years, they were in business for about 25 years. Mm-hmm. After years, they learned that the particulars of how to get these really rich colors and what the public wanted and gave it to them. And they were hugely successful.
John's documentary is called My Postcard Collection, the Detroit Publishing Story, A History of the American Picture Postcard. And let's listen to a clip now from John's documentary showing the way that the postcards produced in Detroit could tell the story of the great San Francisco earthquake of 1906.
Postcards were news vehicles 100 years ago. They gave people the visual substance for their thoughts. They were the news of the day. Imagine yourself standing next to the Latte Fountain, downtown San Francisco, April 18th, 1906. This is where Enrico Caruso witnessed, from his window in the Palace Hotel, the destruction of San Francisco from an earthquake.
John, tell us, in your view, as you study these postcards, what do we learn about our nation and about our state from looking at these postcards from the end of the 1800s, beginning of the 1900s?
You know, it's hard to estimate how much you can derive from that because, you know, a picture is worth 1,000 words. Mm-hmm. Postcards worth 1,000,000 memories. It's hard to estimate what you gain from that. But for myself, I was amazed. I would go to the scene where the postcard was made, and I would look at that scene, and I'd say, now it's 100 years since that image was made, and now I'm looking at it today. What information do I get? And in between that is a great wealth of information. I found out things about America I had no idea.
Such as?
Well, the Flatiron Building in New York, how it was built, and I had progressive cards of that Flatiron Building, and everybody loved it, and they made gazillions of postcards of the Flatiron Building, and there it was. It was sort of interesting to see how it changed, how the traffic patterns changed. Like Times Square, I collected cards from 1900, and then every two or three years they would make another card from that very same angle. And it was like the photographers went to the same spot to take that picture. So you could line these up and see a kind of a time lapse of 100 years history of a place.
And your documentary takes us into the city of Detroit in a big way to let us see the changing skyline, let us travel up Woodward Avenue and see buildings that we see today, the Whitney, for example. And there it is. There's the postcard from back 100 years ago showing us that. It is quite rich. And they were actually very clever, weren't they? The Detroit Publishing Company was very good at taking a billboard from someplace in Philadelphia and just popping up that little name up there, weren't they?
Right. We called it cut and paste in my day.
Yes.
It's, you know, there's this scene of Adams Square and there's a billboard. And the original billboard was for Dewar's Whiskey. Well, they cut that out and put their own billboard up called Advertising Detroit Publishing.
That's great.
And I should tell you, too, about the Southwest, it was more about how the West was sold than how the West was won.
It had been won by then. It really had been conquered, hadn't it?
But the problem with – they built the railroad leading from St. Louis down to L.A. The problem was they needed to create tourism. They needed to get people to come to the Southwest. And the problem with the Southwest, there were no women in the Southwest. So I collected maybe a dozen postcards where the first edition shows – pile of rocks. And the next edition, they cut and pasted a woman and planted her right in the scene. So it looked much more attractive to come to that part of the Southwest.
Good marketing.
Yeah.
You know, as I watched your documentary, John Collier, and saw so many postcards from those first years of the 20th century, I was not only struck by the color and the life and the clarity, but the openness. In fact, one of the experts in your film spoke of the luxury of space. And it kind of seems like something that we will probably not see again. It's almost kind of poignant looking at that openness and the luxury of space.
That's right. You know, we're so conditioned to just absorb noise in our minds for what we see and what we hear that we really lost a kind of a clarity of vision or a clarity of hearing, you know, so that we know and can appreciate what's really good. And I think that the photography for Detroit Publishing was superlative to any other form of photography. Mm-hmm. They were what you call straight pictures, but they were clean and interesting to look at. And they really caught the public's imagination because the people that put them out were very learned. They, you know, Livingstone, the owner of Detroit Publishing, also owned the local Detroit Journal newspaper, and he was a shipping magnat, and he actually built the Dime Bank building right in downtown Detroit. And I guess it's owned by Dan Gilbert now.
Yeah.
But it's this great old building, and they had, you know, they just set up shop, and they were just intellectuals that saw a market. And, you know, some of my friends at Collect Cards wonder how could they make a living? I mean, they made so many cards, but they made, I don't know, what can you say, a tenth of a cent on each card?
Yeah.
So they sustained themselves for 25 years. The lithographic process was an old and arduous, old world kind of craft.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty soon, along about the late teens, there were other lithographic methods that were higher production. They weren't the high quality that Detroit Publishing had, but they made millions and millions of these postcards. And even though they weren't as good, people still bought them. And all into today, people still buy postcards.
They do, although I'm trying to remember the last time I either sent one or got one, and because I used to send them all the time. And it made me wonder if you think, John, have we lost something by turning away from mailing those postcards in favor of tweeting a vacation picture or posting it instantly on Facebook?
Oh, you know, I mean, I'm a technologist fanatic. I love all this stuff that came along.
Yeah.
So somebody comes up to me and goes, oh, isn't it sad that I worked for newspapers for 30 years? Isn't it sad they're dying away? No, because everything that's new that came along is so much more expansive, so much more interesting for our lives, so much more presentation of new and interesting things that we can look at.
Mm.
I mean, when I looked at a New York Times story on the Ganges River, and there were two photographs, one on page one and one with the jump. And it refers you to their website. And there you can see 40 photographs from that same story. So that's like, you know, that's an expansion of your conscious stimulation in your environment. You know, you have more and more to look at than you ever had before.
And we can contribute. So I can take a picture in West Cork, Ireland, and put it up on Instagram and play with colors and do the very same things that the Detroit Publishing Company did with those postcards to create.
Exactly. Exactly. It's really, you know, and it's, I think it's more intellectual. It makes us think more. They talked – when I worked in the newspaper business in the 70s, they're like, oh, this is terrible. The illiteracy is high and we're never going to sell enough newspapers because people will stop reading. Uh-uh. That's not the case. People read more now than they ever have. It may be short, concise sentences, but there's more of that going on than there ever was in all of us and all – levels of society. People are doing more and more of that. I think it's a real stimulant for thinking and for communicating. And, you know, we may be knowing each other better. The people that sent postcards reflected a certain thing about themselves due to cultural conditioning. Same thing today.
I mean, Facebook status updates or your wall or your Instagram account.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
When you say the picture postcard was really as revolutionary in its day as the internet is in ours, it all fits.
Exactly.
We've been speaking with photojournalist and filmmaker John Collier. You can see examples of the old postcards that John's collected and watch clips from his Emmy-nominated documentary, My Postcard Collection, The Detroit Publishing Story, A History of the American Picture Postcard. Just go to his website, mypostcardcollection.net, and we have put a link for you on our website at michiganradio.org. A real pleasure talking with you, John. Thanks so much.
Thank you. It's really great to be here.
Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Erica Decker, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, and April Van Buren. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening. Let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.